organisations, these are the businesses that get formed. There's lots of other businesses around furniture making and so on, and I haven't got time to go into that because that's not really what I'm talking about today. But it'll become a bit clearer why I wanted you to be aware of this part of the work that I do. I want to take us back now, well, bring us up to date, and we're looking at the UK in July 2012 in terms of work. And I think this picture really illustrates to some degree a lot of people's experiences of how work feels. I mean, it feels very stressful, it feels very, very kind of over, it's just too much for people. And I think, you know, we're all aware of the difficult times that we're living in, and I think things like kind of the austerity based around the economic collapse. We've got very high levels of unemployment. Conversely, we've got people, what we would call overemployment, where you have people in work who are getting piled more and more on in very stressful circumstances. And this leads to people feeling very overloaded and often unable to cope. So really herein lies some of the difficulties with work in a contemporary, or in our contemporary society. Part of the reason why this is going on is really we have rapid advances in telecommunications. I mean, it's not just telecommunications, it's technology generally. It's very interesting because, you know, when you look back into even just a few decades ago, this idea was always that technology would make us our lives easier. We would have much more leisure time, we would be able to relax and kick back, and you know. But no, you end up in a very stressful situation because technology is actually making us work harder. And this is one of the kind of fundamental reasons why stress levels are going through the roof. And also part of this is there is still a rapid transition from what was essentially an industrial society into a technological society. So again, this has really kind of made it, you know, quite difficult for people to keep up. People generally don't like change, and they don't like rapid change particularly. So this is really quite a difficult transition for people to have to deal with. I want to just talk about globalisation on the back of the telecommunications issue because telecommunications are so advanced now, that's made the world so much smaller. And in lots of ways, that's partly one of the reasons that facilitated the whole project in South Africa. We can talk weekly by Skype or on email and so on. So even though there's significant benefits to it, there's also a kind of more of a dark side, if you like, or a difficulties with it, because what we're seeing is that people are now having to interact with lots of people from different cultures, different races, which involves different values and belief systems, some of which they're not familiar with. And actually, this is changing work culture. It's changing the way, and it's changing the way that we haven't thought through. We're not aware of what the ramifications of this rapid globalization will be. So really, you know, and also there is this whole idea about the rise of developing nations. And, you know, I've showed you the picture from South Africa. But South Africa, when you go there, is very keen to kind of, you know, you talk to people, they want everything. They want to be much more like a Western society. I mean, things like China and so on. So we know that people aspire to what we've got. But part of the argument that I would like to make is I think we have to question it a bit and just be clear that it's not always a good thing. I think there's also this issue that, you know, when you have rapid transitions and rapid changes, how business has to operate changes with that. It has to have new products, it has to have new ways of working, and again, when you're in a workplace that has to do all of this quickly, that's really difficult if you're at the butt end of it, really hard for people to manage that. So it's that very quick adaptation that people are also good at. The other problems that we've got is really the pace and tempo of work are increasing. And again, this is linked into technology, but also linked into the idea that people have got much, much more to do. Everything is speeding up in a proportionate rate. People are doing more work, they're working longer hours, and there's an expectation that they will execute tasks quicker than ever before. And again, that's linked into people's skills, the way they function, what they're able to do. And not everyone can do this happily or easily. So again, it's worth working that this can be a real problem. And obviously, we're all aware of the kind of economic downturn and, you know, the difficulties that we have with finding and keeping work at the moment. And this is probably, you know, there's a lot of pressure on people in existing work, but also finding work and pressure on job roles, merging like three people's jobs into one, and so on, and just the general principle that everyone's having to do more with less. When we look at how these changes are experienced by kind of employees within organisations, and that can be whether that could be the statutory agency, it can be private sector, it could be charities, because we're all in the same boat to some degree, what we find is that there's much less stable patterns of work. Whereas before, you know, my mum used to tell me, oh, in my day, we used to be able to walk out of one job in the morning, we'd be in another one in the afternoon. And, oh, those days are long gone. I mean, there is no way that that would happen in a contemporary society. People don't have the fluidity or the opportunity now to just kind of pick and choose their work in quite the same way as they had done before. I suppose some of the more pernicious elements of this are things like short-term contracts, part-time work, the changing of business models that people aren't always familiar with, and then the thing about hot desking where you don't actually have a personal space at work, but people get a real problem with that. You feel like an itinerary, you don't know where to put yourself. And then there's the idea that working from home, and lots of people see that as really good, oh, I can work from home, but actually that's also has a real downside, that people tend to work much longer hours, a lot harder when they work from home, as well as juggling commitments that would kept them there in the first place. We talked a bit about less favourable contracting, but this is also kind of linked in with there are rights at work constantly being eroded, and this is usually whether through there's deliberate ideas that short-term contracts should be employed, or attacks on employees' rights. And again, you know, because it's a very highly competitive environment, it's very easy for companies to cut things like wages, holidays, other benefits. And really, we've actually seen since the kind of Thatcher government in the 80s, there has been a constant dilution of union powers. And I mean, you know, I know that people have ideas of whether this is good or not, and I'm not here to make a judgment on that, but all I'm trying to say is that this is the reality that most people work with, and it does have an impact on how work is kind of structured in our society. In terms of, you know, we have complex human resources environments. I mean, we're a very highly regulated workforce. I mean, whether that's through the EU or through our own laws and policies, things like the Equalities Act, the Human Rights Act, again, that they're seen as very kind of positive things in terms of supporting people within work. But by the same token, for some people, they can be really difficult to understand and negotiate what your rights and responsibilities are within these contexts. The other kind of issues that I'm trying to hurry up because I'm a bit short. Technology allows for scrutiny of work as never before. Now, if you think about a call centre, people can log. They log every activity you make, and it's not uncommon for someone to come and bash you around the head in a call centre, go, you're not doing enough. So this is what technology is doing us, and likewise with things like CCTV, we can be monitored at work and our activities and so on. So we're very, very, we're under a lot of scrutiny at work there, and again, this is very, very different from anything we've had to deal with previously. We really need higher level knowledge and skills to compete in the workplace. I mean, obviously, if we've got a highly technological industry base, then we're going to need really kind of quite adept skills to deal with that technology. So very high level intellectual cognitive skills are required, but often quite impressive social skills to negotiate some of the ways in which we interact with the world and our colleagues. And really, obviously, because we're in a period of sort of fairly tumultuous change, people go into change fatigue. And what we mean by change fatigue is really this idea that once people get to a stage where they've had enough and they just cease to function anymore. They literally go into a state of paralysis where they can't take on board any more changes in a positive way. There are impacts to all of these experiences. I mean, in terms of, there's a term called work-life balance, which most of you will be familiar with. Even though this is kind of seen as, can be, you know, there are arguments whether this idea is a myth or a reality. But the general idea is that work shouldn't be the over-encompassing element of your life, and that things like family, leisure pursuits and so on should actually kind of work in a balanced timetabling of activities in your life. And again, we've seen that, obviously, we've talked about people working longer, so therefore, you know, basically they're spending much more time at work, so it's getting skewed much more towards work. And again, the other reason I could get my mobile phone out, you can be always at work, you know, with the technology today. There can be a time when you're never at work if you choose to keep it on you and just look at it all the time, and that's not good for you. There is consistent, competition to compete. There's pressure to compete. There was a discussion in the workshop with Femi, which I think was quite interesting. And I think some of this about this idea of perfectionism and the need to kind of continue to be perfect or to be kind of, the top of your game and all, whatever term you want to use. But, for those of us who work in mental health, there's a thing called type A behaviours, which are characterised by perfectionism and being very driven, and then they go off and have a heart attack at 40 and die. So, it's not a good thing. And obviously, the whole system is gearing people much more towards those types of behaviours. Obviously, we've talked a bit about the skills required for the information age. And, who do you think is going to be most disadvantaged within that? I'm just checking you're still awake. Older workers, absolutely. Older workers are very seriously disadvantaged in terms of modern employment structures. And really, part of the difficulties that they have is that, they haven't grown up with this technology, so it's often much more difficult to just keep abreast of it. And obviously, because it changes so rapidly that, it's difficult. Once you think you're learning, you go, that's it, I don't have to do that anymore. Oh, no. It keeps going on and on and on, and it never, ever stops. And really, this is one of the kind of requirements to continually upskill. That's what we mean by that. It will keep you kind of in that sort of... We all learn. We're all a work in progress. But whether it's you choose to just be learning technology after technology after technology is something that most people don't want. They'd rather do pottery or something nice, But, but this is the position it puts us in. There are unprecedented levels of workplace stress, and we know this. I mean, we know that over £25 billion per year are lost to mental health issues in the workplace, and that's primarily based around people's experience of stress. I could go through loads of hideously boring stats, but I won't. That's my thing. Not many other people share my enthusiasm for that. But anyway, we will move on. And, there is this need for people to develop a more resilient self. Now, I'm doing a workshop on this directly after that. I mean, this is the idea that it takes very different emotional skill sets to manage modern workplace. And I think that really this is something that people aren't used to and that they haven't really got a handle on what that means at this point in time. Even though there is now sort of quite a significant amount of research that backs up what it means to be a resilient person and how you can survive in the modern world, particularly in terms of work. This might be pretty introverted, but I just wanted to quickly run through what we mean by workplace stress. People talk about stress, and it's in common parlance, but we don't necessarily understand what we're talking about all the time. What we're talking about in terms of stress is what we call a stressor, which is a demand that is acted upon a person. And the kind of, when you've got a whole heap of stressors, that is our experience of stress. So I just wanted to kind of make that definition, really. And stressors that are particular to the working environment can be physical, emotional, mental, social, or organisational. I mean, a social stress could be falling out with your work colleague. An emotional stress could be that you're in a very stressful job, like health professions or a con one, police, and so on. Organisation ones are things we've already talked about, too much work, really horrible work patterns, and so on. And there can be acute and chronic stressors. So an acute one could be a sudden kind of incident that happens or a change that has to happen in the workplace, but a chronic one can be ongoing conditions which are actually really detrimental to people's health, it could be poor environment or so on. So these are really things that can add to this experience of workplace stress. We know that some people are more vulnerable than others, and this goes back to the idea of resilience. We know that there are certain things that happen to people, certain attributes that make people more resilient and less vulnerable. So it's really being clear about who, knowing who those people who are vulnerable are and making sure that we can actually kind of give them the support they require to operate within this type of environment. And obviously stress can manifest in a number of ways. It can be physical, like often you'll get people who complain things like bad back, and it could be actually as a result of stress rather than anything else, or kind of mysterious ailments, things like that, emotional things like irritability, just bursting into tears, being very angry. mental ones where you actually do develop a diagnosable mental health problem, you have problems concentrating, thinking, attention, those sorts of things, and behavioural ones where, you know, which are much more linked in towards not coming into work or not doing your work well or just slinking off at like 2 hours before you're due to go home and those sorts of things. There are quite specific signs of organisational stress, and these are really things like high levels of sickness absence. These are most commonly things like people will be signed off for stress, or it will be anxiety, depression are common ones. The other most common reason people are signed off is for musculoskeletal difficulties, usually bad back. But again, you know, we know that from occupational health reports that lots of times bad back can be a sign of stress, and equally there's lots of, it's much more complex than we often think. Obviously, you know, there's going to be decreased productivity, poor industrial relations. There's a fairly recent term which has been coined called presenteeism. And this really refers to when people don't actually go off sick despite being unfit for work. They'll come in and they'll literally be completely unproductive. They're present, but they're not actually doing anything. And again, this is seen as a reaction that people are in a very fearful culture that if they seem to be off sick, they're somehow seen as aberrant, there's something wrong with them, they'll be sacked, and so on. So you end up with this very perverse, behaviour where people come in and they're not well, they shouldn't really be there. And then, you know, that has a really detrimental effect on everyone around them as well. And obviously, when you've got a very highly stressful workplace, you're going to see a very high turnover of staff. Am I going, is this about the right pace for you? Okay. I just want to talk about really the well-being at work agenda. And I mean, I'm talking about this in the widest context in terms of government policy. I'm not going to really talk too much about specific policies. Again, if that's quite boring for most people, even though I quite like it. But anyway, there are a number of government policies that have been designed to address the issue of workplace stress and ill health. Probably the one that people would know about is what's called Working for a Healthier Tomorrow, which was by, it's sometimes called the Dame Carol Black Review. And this was specifically really to look at things like how do we support people within these environments to stay at work, be supported at work. And from this particular policy, we've actually got things like the FIG note. I'm sure some of you are aware that if you go to a GP, you don't get sick note anymore, you get FIG note, which basically says you're well enough to go to work and you can stay off for a couple of weeks and so on. And there's also fit for work schemes, which are essentially what we would call occupational health programs, which enable people the common conditions that people go off with to gain support in certain services that are dotted around. Interestingly enough, the coalition government has continued with policies that were instituted by the former Labour administration. Now, this is unusual in as much as most governments, they'll kind of completely try and overturn whatever the last one's doing. I mean, I don't know really what the politics of that is, whether or not you've got a very kind of close, at the time, a closely centre-left, centre-right split, so there wasn't that much difference between them. But generally speaking, this has been a kind of policy context that has gone on for quite a long time now. At least for the last 8 years, we've had these very key policies that have been going, being put through. We can't really talk about sort of health and well-being at work unless you talk about people who are not at work. And again, obviously the whole idea, I'm sure people are very much aware of the whole welfare to work programs, particularly the ones that are geared up towards getting people who are off sick from work back into work. Yeah, and this is causing a whole heap of disastrous anxiety and really has been very poorly managed, and that's a personal opinion. I've seen people in absolute floods of tears, practically suicidal on the basis of what they're being forced to do. And it's partly to do with the mechanics of it. It's a very poorly designed assessment. And it's not really guided. It doesn't look at in any way, shape or form the complexities of what people have to do when they go into a workplace. So most commonly some of these programs was what's called the work program, which is again is designed as a kind of more mainstream system of getting people back into work. Next year we're going to have what's called the universal credit. This comes out, I believe, in April 2013, and the idea behind the universal credit is it puts all the benefits together, but it also calculates it, so if people do part-time work, they should be in a position to be better off than they were if they were just on benefits alone. So even if you do a couple of hours, you should be better off, and you won't be penalised in the way the benefits system does to you now. Which again, I think is a really laudable aim, because you know benefits are a real difficulty for people trying to get back to work, particularly if you're sick, or you're on some form of kind of sickness benefit. But unfortunately, as things have gone on, it's taken a less than, I suppose, supportive turn in the last year or so particularly. So really we're looking at the thing called the Work Capability Assessment, and this was based on, without going into the details too much around the benefit system, what used to be capacity benefit is now going to what's called a migration. So people are being reassessed to see their eligibility, and they'll either go on to what's called Employment Support Allowance, or if they're deemed fit for work, they'll go on to Job Seekers Allowance. This is what's caused most of the problems with particularly the client group that I work with, the people with mental health problems, but also for anyone with any form of disability, this has been a problem. And really, you know, one of the kind of strangest things for me is obviously, you know, we're hearing of all this stuff about, you know, it's really positive for people with disabilities to go back, and I believe it is, but some of the statistics that are being bandied around are quite erroneous, because over the last decade at least, employment for people with all disabilities has actually kind of risen steadily over that period. The one exception is mental health. That has continued to go down. That's kind of my whistle-stop tour, really, of the kind of current workforce, either the kind of the current sort of status of work, if you like. And really what I want us to kind of think about now and reflect on is really this idea that, we, you know, over the last couple of years particularly, I think the rhetoric around work has been changing somewhat. The first point I'd like to make is about the morality of work. You can't take work out of a moral framework, and you certainly can't take benefits and welfare out of a kind of moral framework. The morality of work goes back centuries. I mean, the things like, you know, it's been very linked into faith, it's been linked to religion, there's the whole thing about the Protestant work ethic and so on. But even in modern day, we have this idea that, you know, somehow work is, even a secular society, work is seen as being somehow morally right. It's linked into these ideas of kind of the notion of being a good citizen, of making a contribution to society and so on. But even, you know, there was an interesting Prime Minister's Question Time. David Cameron made the following statement: "We back the workers; they back the shirkers." Now, personally, that sort of talk makes me wince when I hear it, because I think it's so value laden. But it talks volumes about the morality that we place on work. Yes. By this. Oh, this was they basically. No, it was directed towards the Labour Party. It was directed towards, the Labour Party, based around the benefit reforms. So basically, you know, when we look at this, we are within a moral framework when we have to think about this. And it's also a political one too. You know, we can't take work outside of these discourses. So really, you know, well-being at work then becomes a moral dilemma in as much as it does a political one. Because really, if we've got such an aberrant working culture, and I would say that it's very tricky for lots of people at the current time, and lots of people falling foul of it, would we really push our most vulnerable into that in a very kind of unthinking way? And I think, you know, we have to step back and reflect on some of the things that we do. I think there's other lots of misinformation about things like public versus private sector debates. I'm sure you're all green with envy at my gold-plated public sector pension, which I can assure you is nothing, not really very gold-plated at all. But I think there is a lot of these debates around what is good and what is bad, and I think it's taking this into a moral direction. And I think that this is, we cease to have a neutrality around this idea of how do we discuss these issues in a neutral way which doesn't kind of end up in a political argy-bargy. And I think there is really shifting paradigms about the nature of dependency. And obviously my experiences in South Africa, really, because you did have people who were in a very dependent state. And I see people over here in a very dependent state. They're dependent on mental health service, they're dependent on, you know, welfare benefits and so on. But I think we have to be careful about how do we actually kind of shift people from those spaces into something much more, I suppose, morally correct or justifiable and humane. So really, my closing thing is to take us back to this idea, if we know where we're at now, and this isn't going to go away, I mean, particularly the march of technology won't go away. If this is our future, you know, and I kind of, if you look at the juxtaposition between the two, I think it's actually a very interesting thought, that where do we take this? Do we really want to do this? Can we actually stop this? We know it's not going to do us any good, and we know that it's possibly going to do us a lot of harm. So what power do we have? And I think it raises a whole heap of questions, and it does certainly for me, and that's where I'm going to let you have a ponder.